Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, my education continues in regard to how the law works from the bottom up. I've just discovered. Now, understand, I went to law school. I practiced for a good many years until I made the mistake of defying a criminal judge. Not a criminal court judge, a criminal judge. He destroyed my career. But I still have the training, and I still know how the system is supposed to operate. And according to the U.S. Constitution and the Texas Constitution, those who represent themselves, referred to as pro ses, are to be treated the same as the anointed ones, the attorneys. Well, it's anything but that. I'm in a case right now that some roofers destroyed our house. I mean, destroyed through sheer incompetence. And to add insult to injury, when they couldn't get everything out of me they wanted, they sued for more money. And it's been going on for 5 years. I had an attorney handling my side of it, but he wasn't really paying that much attention. And then he told me he was promised a judgeship if he dropped his controversial cases, of which mine was one. And I said, okay, fine, I'll do it myself. And the judge lectured me for 15 minutes on the necessity of following the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And I had to sign three different documents that I understood and I would follow those rules. Well, then it came out that the roofers had not bothered to respond to discovery. The discovery was due a year ago. So, now my attorney was supposed to know this, and all the work he was getting all the praise for was work I had done and given to him to file. But of course, he didn't tell anybody that. So when it came time to go to court, I said, Judge, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 198. They didn't respond to the request for admission, so they're deemed admitted. Oh, no, we can't do that. Because that would mean that a pro se had beaten an anointed, licensed Texas attorney, and he couldn't allow that in his court. So, 5 years after they filed suit, and after they had not responded to discovery over a year ago, he allowed them to exercise the arbitration clause in the contract they had violated. And I said, you know, Judge, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure say, and he said, shut up and sit down. And then he treated them with the greatest of deference because they were represented by a licensed, anointed Texas attorney. And I said, doesn't the rules mean anything? Shut up and sit down. What he was saying was, under the term judicial discretion, he could make his own law. He could ignore the precedent-setting law from the Court of Appeals. He could ignore the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And he wasn't going to allow me to beat an anointed, licensed Texas attorney. So I filed a notice of appeal because he said, I am ordering this to go to arbitration. But he didn't sign the order for 9 days. And I filed a notice of appeal. And the Court of Appeals said, well, we don't see an order you can appeal from. And the court refused to give me a copy of the order. I didn't get one until yesterday. Now, the order was signed August 28th. I didn't get it until December the 2nd. And on that basis, the Court of Appeals was correct. There was no order. So, I filed another notice of appeal. And I said, the judge made a mistake of law. Well, you'd have thought I'd have said, let's go lynch the Pope. I mean, people became faint. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable. Now, the rules say if you're appealing, you have to pay a filing fee, $205. And if I was represented by an anointed, licensed Texas attorney, that's what it would be. But because my wife and I are pro se, oh no, it's $410. I said, isn't that discriminatory? Shut up and sit down. Now, when I look at everything that's been done, I have a clear case of violation of equal protection of the law and due process of the law. But nobody wants to touch it because if I win, that makes some licensed, anointed Texas attorneys look bad. And some of them, on their best day, my dog could beat them. But they're connected. They're part of the good old boy system. And I am sick to death of the good old boy system. So, we're going to take the court to the Civil Rights Division of the federal court. That the court is violating my civil rights. And see how they like that. Now, none of these people served a day in the military that I can discover. I'm a 100% disabled veteran. And what am I told when I say, wait a minute, you know, don't I have rights? What does the fact you're a disabled veteran have to do with the law? They always get up on their high horse and say, the law. Well, the law is not what the judge wants it to be. The law is what the law says it is. But not in his courtroom. So we're going to say, I'll keep you apprised of whether or not anybody in this state, in the legal system, understands what the term due process means. I had one judge tell me it means whoever paid the most, son. Don't you understand how things work in the real world? Which is why innocent people get convicted every day that comes. And if you are an attorney, a licensed, anointed Texas attorney, blessed by God, and you take a case that is frowned upon by the powers that be, your career is short-lived. Well, last night we were talking about the Kennedy assassination. A lot of new stuff has come to light that I wasn't aware of. Now, I have a tape nobody's heard in 30 years. Well, a gentleman laid out chapter and verse about the cover-up. Well, I got a story today . Basically, it's some interesting things that happened in Dallas. And this story began Sunday afternoon, November 24th, 1963, 2 days after the assassination. In a very short span of time, they had the assassination of the president. They had the shooting of John Connally, the governor, the murder of Officer Tippit, and Oswald shot on national TV. So it was a paradise for a reporter. Well, on this particular evening, there were two reporters, Jim Cody and Bill Hunter. Now, they were ending a long day. Cody was working for the Times Herald. And Hunter had taken a job in California covering the police beat for the Long Beach Press-Telegram. And Hunter got the newspaper to send him to Dallas to cover the Kennedy assassination. Well, the two of them decided to go get a drink. Now, 1963, that wasn't as easy as you might think. They went to a place called Bill Martin's TV Bar. Now, they were going to unwind a little bit and have a quiet drink. But that evening was not as calming as they had hoped. There was a 30-year-old state law. It was put into effect back in the 30s, prohibited the serving of liquor by the drink in a public place. So there were no cocktail bars in Dallas in 1963. So the TV bar served only beer and wine, which I guess there's some folks that are happy with that. And as Cody told his friend, the only beer joint within walking distance of City Hall that was open on a Sunday evening was the TV bar. Favorite place for detectives, municipal bureaucrats, lawyers, bail bondsmen, and news people to get together and chew the fat. Well, as they walked in, Cody spotted three lawyers he knew, C.A. Drobry, Jim Martin, and Tom Howard, all three who had done legal work for Jack Ruby in the past. And they were sitting at one of the tables with an out-of-town writer who's was never identified. Now, having already seen Howard early at the police station, where he'd gone to confer with Ruby, Cody and Hunter walked over and struck up a conversation with the group. And they learned the lawyers were waiting for Ruby's roommate, a man named George Senator, who spent most of that afternoon with the Homicide Bureau being questioned. Now, according to an interview that Drobe gave in 1993, Senator had been held at the police station for 4 or 5 hours. When they finally turned him loose about 6, he came over and met the attorneys at the TV bar. One of the reporters who was there wanted a picture of Ruby, so they decided to go over to the apartment on up in Oak Cliff where Ruby and Senator lived, and that's the same area where Tippit was killed, and see if they could find one. So after several rounds of beer, Cody and Hunter accompanied Senator and three attorneys to the apartment. They got there about 8. They spent about an hour there. And during that time, as Cody said later, he and Hunter roamed freely about the apartment while Senator and the lawyer sat talking in the living room. And according to Droby, there was no evidence to indicate anybody besides Senator had been in the apartment since Ruby left at a little after 10 o'clock that morning, taking his dog Sheba with him en route to the Carousel Club. That's the one he ran in Dallas. Now, according to Droby, the place definitely had not been ransacked, and they assumed the police hadn't gotten around to searching it yet. Well, they looked around, and they couldn't find a picture of Ruby. In fact, they didn't find much of anything. So after a while, they left and went over to Jim Martin's place and had dinner. And he remembered that Senator was scared to stay in the apartment by himself, and he ended up spending the night at Jim Martin's. And although Droby recalls Cody making some notes while at the apartment, no reference to the visit appeared in the next day's edition of the Times Herald. Talking later with his newspaper colleagues about visiting Ruby's place, Cody seemed completely unimpressed. He called it just a dumpy apartment. Well, as far as can be determined, Cody and Hunter, the only two newspaper reporters in the world, ever visit Ruby's home that evening after Ruby killed Oswald on national TV. And they had a leisurely, unsupervised tour of the premises. Well, in light of the strange sequence of events that came to pass over the next 10 months, some independent assassination researchers have put heavy emphasis on the assumption that Cody and Hunter were in the apartment before the police had a chance to search it. Now, clearly, this would have heightened the chance of the two reporters finding something while they were in there and could only make an already intriguing tale even more so. But according to all the parties that were there, that just simply wasn't true. In reality, homicide detective Gus Rose got to Ruby's apartment about 2 p.m. that Sunday, about 2.5 hours after the shooting, accompanied by two other Dallas officers and armed with a search warrant issued by the Justice of the Peace by the name of Joe Brown Jr. During an interview, Rose recalled he showed the manager the warrant and she let us right in. There about an hour and a half and searched the place thoroughly. It was sparsely furnished. He had said he had expected something a little more elaborate because certainly Ruby made a nice living running the Carousel Club. According to Rose, the search failed to turn up anything of significance, though it was deemed important enough that Judge Brown joined the officers at the apartment while the search was going on. Well, there was one closet door that was locked, Rose remembered. He thought maybe there's something important, so they forced the door open. The only thing they found was a box of loose change. They collected a few notes and telephone numbers been written on pads, but that was about all they took. Well, the neatness of what Rose and the other officers carried out their search, plus the fact that no attempt was made to seal off the apartment when they were through, led those who came to the apartment a few hours later to assume that no search had been conducted. Well, it didn't take long for the trouble to start. For Droby, in fact, it began the very next day. Included in a lengthy coverage of Oswald's slaying and Ruby's arrest was one particular paragraph. Now, this appeared on Monday, November 25th, 1963. And this paragraph said, Attorney C.A. Droby, one of the several lawyers who called at police headquarters to consult with Jack Ruby, told police his wife had gotten two threatening phone calls. Both times, Droby said his wife was warned that they'd be next if he defended Ruby. Well, less than a week later, the threats became more specific and a great deal more menacing. He later said, I was in my office at Main and Lamar Streets when I got a call from the police. And the police told him that an anonymous caller had threatened to blow up Droby's car. So he went down to where the car was parked and they had the whole street cordoned off. And there were police and demolition experts everywhere. Didn't find a bomb. That was enough for Droby, though. He said he used to represent Ruby all the time, but he decided he didn't want any part of this case. His wife was so scared she left town for a while, so he decided to leave, too. If Bill Hunter could have sensed what was going to happen to him, he would have gotten out of it as well. But those who knew him best, frankly, doubted it. He loved his job too much to leave, according to anybody who knew him. And besides, unlike Droby, Hunter apparently got no warning. In the words of Keith Shelton, once a co-worker of Cody and Hunter's at the Wichita Falls Record News, now retired as a journalism professor at the University of North Texas, Hunter was the stereotypical hotshot reporter, and he loved the role. He was always outgoing and enthusiastic about his work, Shelton recalled. He was talkative, kind of a loudmouth to tell the truth, but like old guy and a really good reporter. Well, he knew 1,000 bizarre cop stories, and he always enjoyed telling them to friends and acquaintances, but the most bizarre cop story he ever encountered was the one they never got a chance to repeat. It was the one that got him killed. He won a prestigious statewide reporting award for his coverage of the Kennedy assassination in the Long Beach Press-Telegram. Editors were so impressed with his work, they sent him back in February 64 to cover the murder trial of Jack Ruby. And as the newspaper noted in a self-promotional article published today, Hunter left on his new assignment, his on-the-spot reporting will explain the unusual procedures of Texas law, which is based on frontier ideas of justice. I don't think so, folks, unless you're talking about paying off judges. During the next week and a half, Hunter had ample time between trial sessions to get together with his friend, Jim Cody. They undoubtedly did. Only naturally, he hooked up with Cody whenever he's in Dallas, according to Shelton. Hunter's several years older than Cody, but very similar in the way they talked and acted and related on the job. They were a couple of hotshots. Outside of their on-the-job attitude and camaraderie, though, the two actually seemed to have very little in common. Hunter was married and the father of three young children, and Cody was a confirmed bachelor. Hunter was gregarious with almost everybody, made friends easily, while Cody, though he talked easily with people, was something of a loner. And even in a professional sense, they had their differences. According to those who knew both of them, Cody was by far the better writer, and Hunter was a tireless leg man and gatherer of facts. Then Keith Shelton's older brother, Bill Shelton, who'd been instrumental in Hunter's decision to move from Wichita Falls to California. Bill Shelton joined the Press-Telegram as an editor in 58, and a year later, when the paper had been in need of a police reporter, he'd recommended Hunter for the job. Well, Hunter had been back from the Ruby trial for a little over 6 weeks when a disaster struck. About 2 o'clock in the morning of April 23rd, 1964, Hunter was sitting at his desk in the press room of the Long Beach police station and reading a mystery novel entitled Stop This Man when two detectives, both of whom were later described as friends of Hunter, came into the room. Now, at this point, there's some confusion about what took place. One officer is first quoted as saying he dropped his gun, causing it to discharge as it hit the floor. Later, he changed his story and said he and the other detective were engaged in horseplay with their loaded weapons when tragedy struck. Now, I would have to think two experienced detectives, because you don't start out as a detective. You're a rookie police officer, you get some experience, and then if you show the ability, then you're promoted to detective. So they're not going to horseplay with loaded weapons. But whatever the case was, there was a single shot that hit the Hunter where he sat. That .38 caliber bullet went straight through his heart, died instantly. Well, Bill Shelton said his boss called him at 2 a.m. and told him Bill Hunter had been shot. And he wasn't satisfied with the story that the cop had dropped his gun. As it turned out, that wasn't what happened at all. Newspaper charged police with covering up the facts in the case, which Long Beach Police Chief William Mooney vigorously denied. Detective Creighton Wiggins Jr. and Errol Greenleaf were relieved of their duties and subsequently charged with involuntary manslaughter. January 65, both were convicted and given identical three-year probated sentences. 2 weeks after the shooting, in a letter of resignation to the chief, Detective Wiggins wrote, "It's a tragic thing this has to come about in this manner. I've lost a wonderful friend in Bill Hunter, and so have all the police officers in the department." On the day after his death, the fellow Press Telegram staff writer, columnist George Robison, described Hunter as a very personable, enthusiastic, exuberant man who sometimes seemed to boil over with the excitement of life. He was also described as conscientious. And that conscientiousness, when applied in the wrong places, can be an extremely dangerous attribute. And in Hunter's case, it was a fatal attribute. Well, while Hunter's death made sensational headlines in California, it was scarcely noted 2,000 miles away in Dallas. Cody Shirley mourned and missed his friend, but if you connected Hunter's death in any way with their visit to Ruby's apartment, he didn't mention it to any of his acquaintances at the Times-Herald. Inwardly, though, Cody may have been grateful he's no longer required to fill in on the police beat. That spring, he'd landed a full-time feature writing job on the staff of the newspaper's Sunday magazine section. That was considered a plum assignment in the editorial department. He now wrote human interest articles about treasure hunting on the Gulf Coast, trips to the interior of Mexico, and things like that. He spent much of his spare time that spring and summer sailing on White Rock Lake in a 14-foot sailboat, recently purchased by fellow reporter Ben Stevens, who's also dead now. He was known at the time as Cody's closest friend at the Times-Herald. But Cody also spent a good bit of time on his own. Frequently met Stevens and other reporters for an after-work bull session. Sometimes he just sat and drank Bill alone at one or another of the bars in the vicinity of his East Dallas apartment. At some point in mid-September 1964, Stevens and Cody had a falling out during one of their sailing excursions. Stevens, who had a notorious temper, later confided to acquaintances Cody had made some disparaging comments about a certain young female writer with whom Stevens was romantically involved. He also admitted he threatened Cody with a knife to apparently smooth things over after 3 or 4 days. Friday evening, September 18th, Stevens met Cody for a few beers at a joint on Bryan Street. Last time anybody from the Times-Herald saw Cody alive. Cody's last article was a innocuous little feature story on a quarterback punter for the SMU Mustangs football team. About the same time most Dallasites were opening their Sunday newspapers and sipping their first cups of coffee, Cody's mother, Ms. Leola Wurz of Seymour, Texas, was dialing telephone number at Cody's apartment on San Jacinto Avenue. She had tried to get him several times the previous day without success. She didn't have any more success on this day. Having worked over the weekend in connection with the approaching elections, Times-Herald political writer Keith Shelton was still at his suburban home on the morning of September 21st, 1964, when an assistant city editor called a little before 8 with an urgent question. "Want to know if he had any idea where Jim Cody might be?" Shelton said, "No, why?" He said, "Well, he hadn't shown up for work this morning. His mother called here looking for him. She had tried to reach him over the weekend, couldn't get an answer at his apartment." But it turns out nobody who knew him had heard from him. One of them decided to call Cody's landlady and have her check on him. Short time later, having been called by a near-hysterical landlady, police entered Cody's apartment and found the newsman's body on his bedroom floor and wrapped in a blanket. Dallas County Medical Examiner ruled that Cody died sometime between late Saturday night and dawn Sunday, but the cause of death wasn't clear. There were no visible wounds, but an autopsy eventually showed his neck had been broken by a single karate-style blow to the throat. Now, I don't know how much y'all know about that, but that takes some skill. Not a great deal of strength, but certainly some skill. Homicide detectives Charles Doherty and E.R. Beck described the apartment as being in disarray. There were signs of a struggle, and several items, including two rifles and the pistol and Cody's wristwatch, are unaccounted for. Now, Cody's car, a British-made Woolsey, probably the only car of its type in Dallas, was also missing. It became the object of a citywide search until the motorcycle policeman found it parked in the 4600 block of Victor Street, several blocks from the apartment. Investigators dusted the interior of the car for fingerprints, but guess what? They didn't find any prints at all, not even Cody's. Well, on the afternoon of September 22nd, 1964, 10 months to the day after the assassination of Kennedy, and one day short of 5 months since the death of Bill Hunter, Cody was buried in his hometown of Seymour. 5 days later, the Warren Commission issued its report on the assassination, concluding Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. There was no evidence of a conspiracy. Well, justifiably or otherwise, the feeling existed among some Times Herald staff members in the weeks following Cody's death that Dallas police were pursuing their investigation of the case with less than maximum vigor. Now, there was no apparent relationship to the Kennedy assassination, but Cody was the first of four Times Herald newsmen to be mysteriously murdered between 64 and 76, a connection that certainly was worth looking into. The other victims are Eugene Lewis, Hoyt Spurlock, and Ott Hampton. And for obvious reasons, Ben Stevens seemed concerned, but he wasn't the only one. Keith Shelton and Paul Rosenfeld were also eager for an early arrest in the case. George Carter, the paper's veteran senior police reporter, pressed hard to get information through his contacts at the department, especially homicide captain Will Fritz, the man who had taken personal charge of questioning Oswald and was now directing the Cody investigation. Well, for more than a week, Stevens and one or two other staffers who'd been friends of Cody scouted the bars and beer joints that Cody had been known to frequent in search of any kind of lead. Armed with a picture of the dead reporter, they talked to bartenders, waitresses, patrons, asking if they remembered seeing the man in the photo. They were particularly interested in finding out where Cody might have been on the Saturday evening before he was killed and who he might have talked to. In the end, after a lot of time and shoe leather, the quest by Cody's colleagues turned up nothing. Several months later, an ex-convict named Larry Earl Reno was linked to the Cody killing after being arrested in an unrelated incident. One of Cody's guns was reportedly been found in a man's possession, and he'd no alibi for the time period in which Cody had been killed. But while the case was being prepared by the district attorney, Harry Wade's staff for submission to the Dallas County Grand Jury, some strange undercurrents surfaced. And as the courthouse reporter assigned to Wade's office, Stevens quickly picked up on these developments. Some people in the DA's office were saying that this looks more and more like a queer deal, and they say some of Cody's relatives are pressing him to drop the case against Reno to keep embarrassing the family. Well, Stevens was outraged at the idea. Now, there were rumors that Cody was involved with another man, but he said unequivocally, Jim Cody was not homosexual. I spent too much time with him not to know that. Other close associates of Cody agreed with that assessment. Bill Shelton was vehement that this case needed to move forward. Of course, it's only fair to note that none of Cody's friends and acquaintances from the 50s and 60s remember him ever having a regular girlfriend, even dating a woman. Now, this was a time, don't forget, that when being revealed as a homosexual could have cost an individual his career and his entire future. So, if Cody did have homosexual tendencies, he wouldn't have gone to great lengths to conceal them, but at the same time, certainly somebody would have noticed something, especially when he was under the influence of alcohol. The fact that his body was nude when it was found, except he was wrapped in a blanket, undoubtedly fuels speculation about a homosexual connection. It was a suggestion. He unwittingly picked up his killer in a bar and brought him back to the apartment for sex. On the other hand, there was evidence that Cody had just stepped out of the shower when he was surprised by an intruder in the apartment. At any rate, when the case went to the grand jury, the evidence against Reno was highly circumstantial at best, and understandably, the prosecution didn't push as hard as it might have for an indictment. Reno was no billed and only to be re-enlisted early in 65 and charged with the robbery and attempted murder of a Dallas hotel clerk. Subsequently convicted for this and sent to prison, and they dropped all the efforts to link him up with the Cody killing. At the time, nobody in the Dallas media, local law enforcement, or district attorney's office made any connection between Cody's murder and the tragic incident that had taken place 5 months early in Long Beach, much less with an obscure visit to Jack Ruby's apartment 5 months before that. Then there's the case of Tom Howard, the attorney who was convinced he could set Jack Ruby free. And if things had worked out a little differently, he might have been successful. In those early 60s, there were many noted and colorful defense attorneys in Dallas, but none was better known or more respected as a courtroom strategist than Howard. Well, newspaper reports indicate Howard was one of the first civilians to talk to Ruby after the shooting. Dispatch filed by Bill Hunter himself and published the next day in the Long Beach Press-Telegram identified Howard as one of two lawyers who'd conferred with Ruby within minutes of Ruby's execution of Oswald. So it came as no surprise to anybody that a short time later, Ruby asked Howard to head up his defense. And there were some in Dallas who believed Howard was the only man who could have saved Ruby from the death penalty. Well, Bill Stevens, the former courthouse reporter and close friend of Cody's, was well acquainted with Howard, as well as C.A. Droby and Jim Martin, the other two lawyers who were with Cody and Hunter at Ruby's place. Writing in November of 1973, on the 10th anniversary of the assassination, Stevens offered an observation about Howard. He said, after Ruby's conviction, Dallas attorneys, including Droby and Martin, agreed on one thing. Tom Howard, a shrewd and innovative defense lawyer, would have convinced the jury that a moderately long prison term would have been punishment enough for Ruby. Well, while many people at the time undoubtedly harbored a killing rage against Ruby, they were less angered by the fact that Ruby had executed Oswald than by the resulting embarrassment that the Dallas police and the black eye of the city as a whole received. Because of those feelings, Howard sought to move the trial out of Dallas. Of course, he failed. Also because of those feelings, Ruby would probably never have been safe in the outside world, but under Texas law, Howard knew that a chance of getting the charge reduced to murder without malice might have led to an early release of Ruby. Now, the maximum sentence for murder without malice was 5 years, according to former Dallas Morning News police reporter Jim Uhl. Ruby would have qualified for that with consideration for the months he'd already been locked up. He would have served almost no time upon conviction. Droby even suggested Howard might have spared Ruby from serving any prison time at all. Well, whatever clever courtroom strategy Howard might have planned to defend Ruby became a moot point before the trial started in March of 64. Howard was dropped from the defense team in a dispute with Melvin Belli, the flamboyant San Francisco tort attorney who'd been brought in by Earl Ruby, Jack's brother, to lead the defense. Droby said, I don't think Jack had any say-so in letting Tom go. Earl was the one responsible for that. Well, not sharing Howard's intimate knowledge of Ruby's personality, emotions, and background, much less his friendship with Ruby, Belli tried to prove that Jack's actions had been triggered by a medical condition known as psychomotor epilepsy that caused him to act irrationally. I didn't know that was contagious because we've got it all through Congress right now. It was, for all practical purposes, a plea of insanity, but one based on a highly complex set of circumstances, and frankly, it did not work. When Belli's medical experts couldn't prove this psychomotor epilepsy after he based his whole defense on it, the jury had no alternative but to give Jack the electric chair. And that came from Droby. And he also said Jack wasn't crazy or psychotic. He had never had psychiatric treatment in his life. What Tom would have done was picture Jack as a sympathetic character who shot Oswald because he felt sorry for Jack and Kennedy and little John, John, and Carolyn. Emmett Colvin, a highly respected Dallas defense lawyer who worked on Ruby's appeal, supported this portrayal of Ruby. Excuse me. Colvin wrote a November 88 article in the Dallas Morning News, and he said he suddenly saw Mr. Oswald being led for transport, and Ruby, a highly emotional man filled with sorrow over the president's death, pulled out his gun and shot him. In fact, Ruby appeared surprised. The police didn't take too kindly to this act. He thought they wanted Ruby killed, too. Well, after Oswald was, after Howard was ousted from the case, Ruby seemed to lose it. He didn't take the witness stand during his 8-day trial. Belli was the star of that particular show. But a few weeks later, in June of 64, he told members of the Warren Commission, Earl Warren himself, as a matter of fact, that his life was in danger here and begged to be taken to Washington for protection. And they ignored him, of course, because they didn't want to prove what was going on. In March of 65, while Ruby's conviction was still on appeal, an appeal that many legal experts feel might have succeeded, Tom Howard dropped dead of a sudden heart attack. He was only 47. And Ruby said he hadn't been sick at all. It wasn't until more than 2 years after Cody's death that the first ties were established when his murder and Bill Hunter's killing in the JFK case. First person to make the connection was Penn Jones, the editor of the Midlothian Mirror, a weekly newspaper in a small town south of Dallas, author of the controversial book, Forgive My Grief, published in 66. In the very first chapter, he said what went on in that significant meeting in Ruby and Senator's apartment. There are few people left to tell. There's no one in authority to ask the question since the Warren Commission made its final report and has closed the investigation. And as now, most of the rest of the media found the whole idea ludicrous. The reaction of Hunter's friend, columnist George Robison, was typical, suggesting a connection between Jack Ruby and Hunter's death. Robinson wrote in November 25th, 1966 edition of the Long Beach Press-Telegram was absurd and incredible and very profitable for people who sell books based on twisted post hoc logic. And for the record, Jones's book was published at his own expense and generally offered free to anybody who wanted a copy. It was what they call a red ink project and was never undertaken to make money. According to Robison, there may be a few holes in the Warren Commission's investigation, but the mystery death legend isn't one of them. Some researchers have followed Jones's lead in exploring this legend may have weakened their own case by implying that Cody was working on a book related to Ruby and the assassination at the time of his death. And that was not the case. According to Dan Martin, Cody was a good writer. So good he was able to run at about half speed most of the time and get by with it. I never saw him really get energized by anything that had to do with writing, and he definitely wasn't writing a book. If Cody and Hunter did indeed know any secrets about Ruby, they took them to the grave with them. But what if someone suspected Hunter and Cody had knowledge of something that would either link Ruby to JFK or help set Ruby free? Now, this was a far more likely scenario. Ben Stevens, of course, didn't believe it, and remarked to a friend many years later that that didn't mean somebody didn't think it. Of the six people who were together in Ruby's apartment on the evening of November 24th, 1963, only two were still alive when all this material was put together. George Senator, Ruby's roommate, died in the spring of 92 of undetermined causes. Cody, Hunter, and Howard were among 18 people connected in some way to Kennedy, Ruby, or Oswald who died. 13 of them violently within 3 years after the assassination. Insurance actuaries have concluded that the odds against this happening were astronomically high. Since then, the list of mysterious victims has grown into the hundreds. And 49 years after the fact, the murder of Jim Cote remains on the books of the Dallas Police Department as an unsolved crime. Well, there's a lot of interesting trails to follow when you talk about the Kennedy assassination. I think you'll find the assassination files is going to be a fascinating trip down some of these lanes. Now, in October of 1962, President Kennedy appeared on nationwide TV to tell the American people U.S. military reconnaissance had discovered a buildup of offensive missiles in Cuba. This is the Cuban Missile Crisis. The missiles, which were fully capable of striking many major cities in the eastern half of the U.S., have been supplied by the Soviet Union, and they were controlled and manned by specially trained Soviet troops. Kennedy, of course, demanded the immediate removal of the missiles and declared an air and naval blockade of Cuba. At no time during the Cold War had the massive forces of East and West appeared so close to actual armed conflict. And for more than a week, everybody held their breath. I remember in those days, we were told to practice drills of wherever you were at, falling to the floor and covering your head or crawling under a desk. Finally, on the evening of Friday, November 2nd, 1962, after weeks of tension in which the U.S. had been pushed to the brink of war with the Soviet Union, Kennedy announced the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the end of the threat. Convoy of Soviet ships bound for Cuba with military hardware turned back, and the Soviet government agreed to dismantle the missile bases and take its weapons home. Well, it was a moment of supreme national triumph, but it also may have led to one of the greatest tragedies in American history. The brutally ironic twist of fate, America's celebrated victory in the Cuban Missile Crisis, may have set in motion the plot that would result in the murder of John Kennedy. Now, this was a conclusion of a former Secret Service officer and a former FBI expert named Jim Norris. Spent more than 18 years protecting four U.S. presidents and studying the motions, mannerisms, and motives of the communist regimes that opposed them. Norris served in the Secret Service's Executive Protection Service, retired in 75 with the rank of captain in the Foreign Mission Division. He began his own investigation of the Kennedy case in the early 70s, while he was still an active Secret Service officer. That investigation covered more than 20 years, and his knowledge of the federal security agencies, how they worked, was considered unsurpassed. He was convinced the plot to kill Kennedy was hatched within the walls of the Kremlin itself only a few weeks after the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a desperate, face-saving attempt at retribution by an angered and embarrassed Nikita Khrushchev. Well, Norris put together what he believes is a very logical scenario. Called himself Sobo, or simply S. Nobody really knows what his real name was. To American diplomats, military officers, and security personnel with whom he rubbed shoulders in the 60s as a third secretary in the Soviet embassy in Washington, he was a slight, personable man with a well-developed sense of humor. Sort of person that fit in anywhere and was a favorite at Washington social gatherings. Well, what very few people knew was he was very high-level KGB. He was also the leader of an elite group of highly trained professional saboteurs and assassins known as the Spetsnaz. That was the Soviet Secret Service. The Soviet version of the Green Beret. That was a group so shrouded in shadow and secrecy it was virtually unknown outside the USSR, and even many officials in the Kremlin didn't know it existed. And it was this connection, according to the scenario put together by Norris, that the man called Sobo was summoned back to Moscow late in 62 and given a top secret assignment. Well, as it was put together later, upon arriving in Moscow, Sobo was ushered into a small room deep in the bowels of the Kremlin. Found himself suddenly face to face with Oleg Troyanovsky, top aide to Nikita Khrushchev, who was unquestionably the single most powerful individual on Earth at that moment. But because of his defeat in Cuba, his iron-fisted rule was being questioned in Communist Party circles. Well, the fact that he was meeting with somebody of the level of Troyanovsky puzzled him. They asked him why he had been summoned, and he said political necessity. And he made him swear an oath that nothing he said in that room would be repeated outside the room under any circumstances. It's an extremely secretive assignment, and it has to be handled outside regular KGB channels. And Sobo agreed. And his instructions were, assemble a team of your most trusted Spetsnaz operatives for a political assassination inside the U.S. They have to be expert marksmen, and if possible, they should be American-born and have no connection to the Soviet Union. Well, Sobo said, ask where this was going to take place, and Troyanovsky said, it's up to you. But I would think, since the subject travels a great deal, it'd be easier somewhere outside of Washington. Well, he asked who the subject was he was to assassinate, and he was told the president. Khrushchev didn't think Kennedy was going to be as formidable an opponent as he turned out to be, so he decided to remove him from the table. Well, Sobo spent a lot of hours trying to figure out how to go about doing this. And it was clear to the insiders that Khrushchev was over his head in dealing with Kennedy. So Kennedy had to be removed. And the feeling by the Soviet insiders was that Kennedy made Khrushchev look exactly like what he was, an overbearing bully, a crude buffoon on the international stage. Well, in less than 2 years as president, Kennedy had embarrassed Khrushchev in Berlin, stolen much of his thunder in the space race, shored up the rest of the alliance just as it appeared NATO was weakening, and used world opinion to force the Kremlin even closer to a nuclear test ban treaty that would have hurt the Soviet Union much more than it would hurt the U.S. In fact, Kennedy's only major foul-up, as far as anybody could see, turned out to be the Bay of Pigs fiasco, which was actually created by the CIA. Well, when he got back to Washington, he kept his eyes and ears open at the frequent parties he attended. He'd already managed to put two of his trusted agents, both native born Americans, within the U.S. security agencies. There were others who held high-ranking jobs at various levels of government, and a few in large municipal police forces. And he knew if he could pull this off, he could write his own ticket with his Soviet masters. Well, in April of 63, the White House officially announced Kennedy would be traveling to Texas during the fall on an important goodwill mission. His vice president, Lyndon Johnson, of course, was a Texan, and he had brought Texas into the Democratic Party for the election that put Kennedy in office. But there was talk that, at the urging of Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy is going to choose another running mate. And it was announced that after making several stops in major cities, the final stop would be in Dallas. Well, Sobo had never been to Texas, but from all accounts, it was an open, informal, relaxed sort of place. And it had a volatile side to its nature, a kind of cowboy mentality. People in Texas are great believers in settling issues by direct, even violent action. Murders, assaults, and other forms of mayhem were considered commonplace. Well, among the 500 Spetsnaz agents that Sobo was said to have had scattered across the U.S., there were a dozen living undercover in Texas. There were two in Houston and two in Dallas. One was even a policeman. And they would be in an excellent position to put together a plan to assassinate the president. Well, it was determined to make sure the mission was a success, they had to have three riflemen. Two would have to be among the most steel-nerved and accurate marksmen in the world, and the third didn't have to be all that good. The third would be totally expendable, a sacrificial lamb, so to speak. And this decoy assassin, if you will, was a former Marine who had worked for both the KGB and the CIA, and that was Lee Harvey Oswald. That ex-Marine was living in New Orleans at the moment, but he'd already been contacted and prepared to move to Dallas on short notice as soon as it became necessary. Well, long and the short of it is, there was a belief by a number of people that Kennedy's assassination was organized by Russians. And what it did is it saved Johnson's career. And it would explain a lot of the inconsistencies in the Warren Commission's case, if in fact this was a Russian organized assassination. Now, clearly, there is evidence that if in fact it was a conspiracy, some of the conspirators had to be on the Dallas police force. Certainly, they had a lot of help. They couldn't have organized any other way. And to set up Oswald as the patsy, well, that broadcast on the police band that the president's assassin was at the movie theater certainly opened up the possibility of suicide by police. But instead of shooting him, they just overpowered him, disarmed him. The weapon he had been given, and he never would say where it came from, didn't have a firing pin. So, well, after the assassination, Sobo was called back to Moscow. And kind of faded into the woodwork. We've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be talking more about the Kennedy assassination tomorrow night. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.